Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lav Harkov, a diplomatic reporter and senior contributing editor for the Jerusalem Post. And I'm with, as always, with Yaakov Katz, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. This week, we are speaking a few days before Yom Kippur, and we were thinking about apologies and people who have things to be sorry for or have said sorry in the past year.
And there's no shortage of those, Lahav, especially when it comes to politics, right?
That's for sure. Yeah, I had started out thinking about Miki Zohar, who was sort of a senior Knesset member in Likud and was famous for how nasty he was to his political opponents, a lot of ad hominem attacks and things like that. And about a year ago, I looked it up, it was a couple weeks after Yom Kippur last year, he announced that he's going to speak differently to people. He's going to be nicer to people. And I think he really did it, actually. I mean, I can't think of, and I poked around looking for it, I can't think of something super controversial that he said in the last year. You know, it just, I found that almost inspiring in a way that, okay, there is another way that maybe some politicians can have a wake-up call and change their behavior somewhat. There are quite a few others, I think, who should join him.
Now, I mean, just important to point out that Miki Zohar, who was a member of Likud and very much seen as kind of like a Bibi loyalist, was the same guy who in, I think, October of 2020, or shortly before that, said, what threatened the Attorney General, right, Mandelblit, that more bad kind of recordings about him, negative publicity would be coming out, very critical of the judiciary. He was kind of, I mean, he was one of the more, some people even compared him to speaking like a mafioso in the way he
spoke. Yeah, I mean, he was like the Likud attack dog.
He was the Likud attack dog. And he very much changed. I think he became soft-spoken. He doesn't, he's not one of these guys who yells anymore. It's been an interesting kind of transformation to see. But I think, you know him personally. I've never met him, but I've heard from people who do know him that he actually is a really nice guy, and that this whole image that was created of him from the way he was portrayed in the media because of how aggressive he was actually not the Miki Zohar who people knew privately.
Well, I think that there are sort of two different things that can happen at the same time, and this happens a lot with the Knesset, which is that in an interpersonal sort of relationship, they can be nice, and he is very nice to me, and also just very accessible, you know, like isn't someone who will ignore me. If he can't answer my question, he'll say, sorry, I can't answer my question, which a lot of politicians will just ignore you. But he still holds very sharp opinions. He's still, you know, very harshly critical of people he doesn't agree with. I think that he's brought those things maybe into balance better. I will say that when I sort of got to know him better over, you know, around 5 years of covering him in the Knesset, he's smarter than I thought he was based on the fact that he was this person who was yelling at people and insulting people all the time, you know, and right. I think maybe people don't realize that, or maybe they don't care that they don't look particularly intelligent when they do that, you know, and that you're going to lose some voters based on that.
Yeah, the Knesset also, as we know, unfortunately, does not always bring out the best in people. Another real recent apology was by former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who made the horrific mistake, and I say that with a bit of sarcasm, in calling Olympic medalist, was it Linoy Ashram, on Shabbat, right? She won the gold medal in rhythmic gymnastics, I think I said that right?
Yes.
And which was a huge success for Israel. The competition in Tokyo was on Shabbat, and Bibi called her on Shabbat while Prime Minister Bennett and President Herzog all, I think, waited till after the Shabbat had ended to place that phone call. And Bibi got slammed by his Haredi ultra-Orthodox political allies. What was that about?
Well, I think, you know, Bibi's quote-unquote natural partners are the religious parties. And, you know, in the past, governments have fallen over violations of Shabbat by, you know, government agencies. And his last government, I guess it wasn't two governments ago, was challenged on Shabbat issues as well. So his partners are very sensitive about it. And he, I guess, once he saw people were calling him out for doing it on Shabbat, he felt he had to apologize. But I think that the ridiculous thing is that he felt he had to like one up Bennett over something like this. You know what I mean? Like, it's so clearly that he was so, you know, enthusiastic to one up Bennett, to be the first person who has the call with Linoy Ashram, that he, you know, forgot about Shabbat. And it's just a completely ridiculous thing for him to try to one up Bennett on.
But here's what I didn't understand from that whole story is that he's no longer prime minister. He's the head of opposition. Like, why would the ultra-Orthodox parties care what he does as the leader of the opposition? He's not calling as the prime minister of Israel.
No, but I guess, you know, they have a block. He is sort of their political partner, their sort of leader within the Knesset of their block. And so he felt, but I don't, as far as I can tell, I don't think that any actual Haredi Knesset members said anything. It was more like, you know, the media that is normally supportive of Netanyahu in the Haredi world.
By the way, Bennett, also came under criticism this past weekend when he went in the middle of the night on Friday. I think it was like at 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. He went to the command center of the police searching for those six fugitives who had broken out of the Gilboa prison. As we're speaking now, four of them have already been captured. But he went to the police command post on Shabbat, and Bennett is an observant Jew. And some people went after him for that, of what is he doing? You know, when a prime minister travels, it's not just him. There's convoys and there's cars and there's advance teams, etc. And he was causing a lot of people to so-called desecrate the Sabbath. I think, you know, that is his job as prime minister. He needs to go, whether it's Shabbat, it's Rosh Hashanah, it's Yom Kippur, he needs to run the country. And part of running the country is seeing these things up front and going out to the field.
I wonder if it had to be on Shabbat. But knowing Bennett, and you and I know him, he's just such a hands-on person that I'm sure that he felt that it was necessary for him to actually be there, even if I have my doubts about it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would hope that, look, at the end of the day, you have to run a country, whether it's, you know, Shabbat's there or Shabbat's not there. The if we're already on the BB topic, though, of apologies, there's one that I know you weren't too excited to talk about, but I think it is worth mentioning, and that is Yair Netanyahu's oldest son, who apologized to Wexner fellows, right? It was Yair Netanyahu who last year called the Wexner is it's named for Leslie Wexner, who's a big philanthropist.
And he's the owner of L Brands, which is like Victoria's Secret, The Limited, like a lot of clothing brands that are in like every single mall in America.
And Yair Netanyahu, the son of the former prime minister, tweeted last year that the fellows of this Wexner fellowship, these are usually government employees who get a fellowship to go to the Harvard Kennedy School for a year, and it's funded by the Wexner Foundation and family. And he called them a secret cult. He called them a pedophile cult.
Right, pedophiles. And the reason, I mean, definitely not justifying him, but the reason that he called them a pedophile cult is because Wexner was very, very close with Jeffrey Epstein. And like, it seems like Jeffrey Epstein's money mostly came from Wexner. And there's a lot of, I think, mystery around that relationship. Now, that doesn't make these people who did this fellowship pedophiles, but that's, you know,
by the way,
a little...
I mean, just important to point out, some of the leading people in the Israeli civil service are graduates of the Wexner fellowship. There is Avi Kochavi, who's the chief of staff. There is Tziona Koenig Yair, who is the director general of the Ministry of Diaspora Affairs. There are people in the Justice Ministry and the Finance Ministry. I mean, no matter where you look in this country, in government and top levels, you have graduates of the Wexner Fellowship. So I think that, you know, he came under a lot of criticism for that. He was threatened with a lawsuit, and that's what ultimately led him just about a month and a half ago to issue an official apology to the alumni of the Wexner Fellowship. And there was another one that we spoke of, Lahav, which was from Yair Lapid, right? Yair Lapid, on the night that the new government was sworn in, had an interesting apology.
Well, it was a gimmick apology. He right. You know, there was a whole vote on when you swear in the government, there's a vote on swearing in the government, and everybody gets to give a speech if they want. And, you know, it was just mudslinging, hours and hours and hours of mudslinging. And so then Lapid got up and basically said, like, I'm sorry that I brought my mother here, or I'm sorry that my mother had to sit here to hear all of these speeches. And then it was just like mic drop, you know, he left.
Yeah, and that actually made some noise, but it was very appropriate, because that was really probably, I don't know, in the 20 years or so that I've been working as a journalist, it was probably one of the worst that I've ever seen the Knesset be.
It was very ugly.
It was quite ugly, and it wasn't something that you usually see. And the last one that we came up with was from Benny Gantz. Gantz apologized to Lapid, right? Because Benny Gantz, who's now the defense minister, used to be Yair Lapid's top partner when they were running Blue and White together. Then when Benny Gantz went into the government with Netanyahu last year, and Yair Lapid broke off from Benny Gantz, refused to join, became very critical of his former partner. At some point, Benny Gantz said that Yair Lapid hates people. And that was actually something that was recorded. He came under criticism for it. And after joining the government that's led by Ben and Lapid, I guess maybe as a way to try to heal some of those, some of the bad blood between him and Lapid, he apologized for saying that Lapid hates people. It's an interesting apology. Benny Gantz is not one known for his, I would say, vulgarity, or for being someone who speaks ill of other people. He's usually very mellow and laid back and takes things in stride. But clearly, Lapid had gotten under his skin. And it's no secret that Gantz is not a happy camper in this government, right? He does not hide his frustration and disappointment with the fact that he's not prime minister, and Naftali Bennett, who has less seats than he even has, is serving as the prime minister of Israel when he was supposed to be the prime minister, right, under the coalition agreement that he had signed with Netanyahu and then later fell apart. But it was an attempt, and, you know, it seems that he's trying to keep things together. So that apology has some value, at least on a political level, for the future of this government.
The last apology, which I believe we had discussed in an earlier episode, was Naftali Bennett, prime minister, had to apologize, or he made, I think it was a public apology, to the parents of Barel Shmueli, who is a soldier who was shot by a sniper fire from Gaza a few weeks ago. And he was in the hospital, and Bennett called his family, but messed up his name and some other details
totally
of the situation.
It. Right. Yeah. Called him Yossi when Yossi was the father he was speaking to, asked Yossi the father which hospital his son was in. And at the time, it was like everyone in this country knew that he was being treated in Soroka Hospital. It was also, when you listen to the recording, which the family later posted on Facebook, you could pretty much tell that Bennett was not focused. He was distracted. He was thinking probably about something else. I don't know what. That's not an excuse, but that was a big, huge bungle. And to his credit, he apologized right away for it, which you don't often get, right? I mean, politicians don't often apologize. That's new in this country.
Yeah. That's true. Right. And I mean, in other countries, politicians apologize and then resign. Not that I think Bennett should have resigned over that.
In Israel, people don't resign, right? We see that now with the aftermath of the Gilboa prison breakout. There's no one who's lost their job. We saw that after the Meron disaster on Lag BaOmer, 45 people killed. No one has lost their job since then. In Israel, we have an issue with accountability.
Yeah, there's not really a word for accountability. It is. I remember there was a politician, there was this Jeremy Gimpel, who does sort of pro-Israel online webisode type things. He ran for Knesset. And I remember that part of his like stump speech was that there's no word in Hebrew for accountability, but that he will bring accountability to the Knesset. So that's something that always sticks with me when people talk about accountability, that, you know, not only do Israeli politicians not have it, there's not really a good word for it.
You know, but I wonder, I mean, I've always wondered why that is. Like, why don't we have that culture? You know, like in South Korea, or I'm sorry, in Taiwan, earlier this year, there was this train accident, and within days, the transportation minister had stepped down, right? You have countries where immediate failure or disaster leads to immediate resignation or some sort of punishment, whether self-inflicted or it's understood that the leader of that government will not allow that person to continue in their job. And here, we just don't have that, right? People don't just simply pack up and leave. It's interesting when you think about why that is.
Well, maybe to bring it back to Yom Kippur, it has to do with that we have a concept of tshuva, that when you do something wrong, if you sincerely apologize and you sincerely regret it and don't do it again, then you can be absolved.
It's possible. I mean, maybe that's because we have that option, and therefore, you know, you can just apologize and move on. It might be the case. You know, there are religions where they have this concept of confession, right, which also kind of gives you the ability to move on. But in those countries, also, people do pay a price. I think that it's, I don't know. It's something we're thinking about. It's worth thinking about this Yom Kippur. It's worth giving a consideration. If we're already in the mood of apologizing to the Lahav, I just want to add one more. You know, as the editor of the Jerusalem Post, this is an opportunity for me to say that I hope that we as a newspaper have not harmed anyone or hurt anyone. You know, part of what we do as a newspaper, obviously, is tell stories. We write about people. Whenever we write personal about people's personal matters, this isn't just covering the news or diplomatic affairs like you write about every day or security affairs. Those are the moments, those are the stories where my hand tends to tremble of what will happen of someone's personal life that we're actually affecting. It's not just a story about a government or about nations, but it's about people's personal livelihood and their families and what's going to happen next. And we tend to take those stories very seriously and be very careful with the way we approach them and how we report on them. And sometimes we've walked away from stories because we felt that we didn't have enough information or evidence to go through. And some stories we did go through with. And it's a responsibility that I think, you know, we as at the paper take very seriously and carry it as understanding what the implications and consequences could be. But I'm sure that not everyone's going to be happy with this. I'm sure not everyone's going to be happy with the way we report on issues, with the way we tell our stories, with the way we look at and report on the matters that are taking place in the state of Israel. To those who are upset at us, I'm not always going to apologize because we also stand by what we say. But I do hope that we haven't done anything in too great an error that has caused anyone too much of pain and suffering. So for that, if that did happen, then I will take this opportunity before Yom Kippur to apologize. Now, you, Lahav, have a conversation coming up later in the podcast with Dan Diker, right? You want to tell us what that is?
Yeah, so Dan Diker is a senior fellow at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, and he is almost like the premier expert on delegitimization of Israel. He wrote a book about BDS, which is a free ebook that people can download online. And I spoke to him ahead of the Durban conference, which is next week. It's in the middle of Sukkot. It is actually on when Jews in the diaspora observe Sukkot, so observant Jews can't go to it, which is, of course, fitting because it is the 20th anniversary of the original Durban conference, titled the World Conference Against Racism, which was marked by an extreme form of racism, anti-Semitism. There were two parts to it. There was the NGO forum, the government, and the sort of main government section of it. Each had its own resolutions. The government one was bad enough. It singled Israel out as the only country that was specifically mentioned as racist. But the NGO forum went even further, calling Israel an apartheid state, basically saying that there's no right for a Jewish state to exist. And at the event itself, people were handing out flyers that said, you know, Hitler should have finished the job, and spelling the protocols of the Elders of Zion. So really a massive anti-Semitic event that was somewhat overshadowed by the fact that it happened a few days before 9/11. But 17 countries have now announced that they're boycotting it. You know, all democracies, you know, and so it's Israel's allies, mostly in Europe, but also US, Canada, Australia. And so that event is coming up, and Dan's going to talk about, I guess, what the impact was of the original Durban conference and what he thinks is going to happen now. I'm here with Dan Diker from the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, who is perhaps best known as an expert on delegitimization of Israel. And we're here to talk on the 20th anniversary of the World Conference Against Racism in Durban. And Dan, want to tell our readers who might not know why this conference is of special interest to people who are interested in Israel?
Well, Lahav, it's a very important conversation and a very good question. If we go back 20 years, 7 days just before the 9/11 attack, a different type of 9/11 took place, which was an ideological, rhetorical 9/11 that was called the World Conference Against Racism. It's a shortened version that was held in Durban, South Africa. And it was the first UN-sanctioned conference that was really to collectively, in a global sense, make a firm statement against slavery, against all kinds of racism, oppression, and related intolerances, including xenophobia. And what that conference turned into, it turned into a carnival of hatred against one country, one of the smallest countries in the world, and that's the state of Israel. So what was supposed to have been a conference for human rights and a conference against racism became a racist conference against Israel.
You know, a few days later, 9/11 happened, and I think in a way, I mean, clearly it was very overshadowed by 9/11, but still really had a lasting impact, I think, on the dialogue about Israel. I mean, people talk about this being the sort of inception of the Israel is apartheid accusation. So how do you think that this has impacted the conversation about Israel in the last 20 years?
Well, that's a key question, because the unique contribution, if you will, of the first Durban review conference, of the first Durban conference in from August 31 to September 8th, 2001, was the mainstreaming and normalizing of the term Israel as apartheid. And we've called that now the apartheid anti-Semites, or the apartheid anti-Semitism, because what Durban did was to take what was had been essentially a territorial conflict between the Palestinian Authority, created and established first in 1995, but based on the Oslo exchange of letters in 1993 between the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, the State of Israel, and turned that territorial conflict into a racial conflict. In other words, what Durban did was to regularize Israel as an incorrigible evil that was based on systemic racism, modeled after the apartheid regime in South Africa, and referenced, by the way, Nazified. As Fiamma Nirenstein wrote in her recent monograph at the Jerusalem Center, Nazified by calling Israel an illegal occupier, essentially denying Israel any sort of sovereign rights for Jews. That underlied the apartheid accusation. But Durban regularized and normalized the Israel apartheid discourse in the international community, particularly because it had UN sanction, even though Mary Robinson, the UN representative at that time, and the UN disassociated itself from the NGO conference at the end of the that summarized at the end of the 2001 conference that Israel was a genocidal apartheid regime. Nonetheless, as you point out in your question, that libel, that slander, stuck to Israel and became mainstreamed in the international discussion about Israel. And we see today, fast forward 20 years later, you go onto any university campus in North America, and Israel apartheid is, you know, as basic as the core curriculum in any major university.
You know, it's interesting because, so just to clarify for those who don't know, there was the sort of main forum of countries that came out with a resolution, and they also singled out Israel. Israel was the only country specifically mentioned as a perpetrator of racism. But of course, the NGO forum declaration was much worse and said, you know, Israel's genocidal and apartheid. But like famously at the NGO forum, there was this flyer that was being given out everywhere that said, if Hitler was alive today, you know, he would have finished the job. There would have been no more Israel. But on the downside, we might not have had the Volkswagen Beetle. This was their idea of humor. And then also they were selling, I believe, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And somehow you had, you know, completely mainstream NGOs like Human Rights Watch who participated and didn't, you know, distance themselves from the conference.
It's absolutely correct. In fact, you make an important point because there was blatant blood libel anti-Semitism against Jews in the classical sense of the word at Durban. And that has also remained as an extension of the whole apartheid anti-Semitism against the Jewish and democratic state has been an increase. You can see it if you look at the graph on, you know, on mainstream anti-Semitic medieval blood libel and anti-Semitic tropes against Jews. Regardless of Israel, right? So the entire enterprise of anti-Semitism, you know, has intensified and metastasized, and the engine, if you will, of that metastasis was Durban. And so it is extraordinary where you saw images of Jews with hooked noses, and you know, and other anti-Semitic representations, as you just pointed out, at Durban, and none of the human rights organizations differentiated between what they might call legitimate criticism of Israel in inverted commas and these blatant bloody images of Jews as reflections of medieval anti-Semitic tropes.
People talk about this also being sort of the beginning of the BDS movement. Is that because real South African apartheid faced the BDS movement, or was there something specific that happened at Durban?
Well, Durban was known as the, let's call it the seed of the, or the engine of the, what we know today as the BDS movement. It's my view, that the official BDS movement as a movement, as an internationally packaged campaign began in 2004 with PACBI, the Palestinian Academic, and cultural boycott of Israel, and that was followed by the 2005 call, C-A-L-L in inverted commas, that came out of Ramallah. It's the view of others that the BDS campaign, because of the nomenclature and the references that were clearly in effect at the NGO forum, represented the actual launch of the BDS campaign. But I would, as I argued in my book, BDS Unmasked, that's available online actually for free. That Durban really provided the seed, and the poisonous root of what would become known as the BDS movement. But the international BDS movement, make no mistake, I've argued for 20 years, is an overtly anti-Semitic movement, and the Germans, and the Bundes, you know, in the first cross party, resolution, the Germans confirmed that in, you know, a couple of years ago when they passed an historic, resolution condemning the BDS movement as overtly anti-Semitic. So Durban was far more dangerous, I think, Lahav, than people in Israel or in the West give it credit for. I think that we should look at Durban was a national security event, a crisis of massive proportions, and it was followed by three more review conferences, the fourth of which is upon us, in the coming days, in New York. And this is a major problem for Israel, because the infrastructure of Durban is eliminationist toward Israel. It is not a conference that demands a two-state for two peoples political solution between us and the Palestinian Authority. It is a conference that essentially, in intention, in form, and in content, calls for the elimination of Israel as a nation state of the Jewish people and has international sanction. That is, according to, most understandings of national security, a major national security challenge for any country. And Israel is the only country in the 193 UN member system that is facing this type of rhetorical existential threat, if you will. There is, the worst human rights violators in the world, North Korea, China, Russia, Iran, the Iranian regime, and the Syrian regime. None of those countries has been attacked as being apartheid regimes, in which there are all forms of apartheid according to the renewed definition that Human Rights Watch, a highly political organization that supposes that it's a human rights organization, but I have very strong doubts as to whether it is, they have redefined apartheid, and that redefinition was rooted in the Durban one conference back in 2001. So when people say, well, how could Israel be an apartheid state? Apartheid meant a government-sanctioned white minority regime governing an oppressed black majority in one country. And here Israel is a non-white majority country with a democracy, with a small minority of Palestinian Muslim and Christian citizens, and also citizens of other backgrounds, such as Druze and Baha'i and Circassians, and by law everyone is guaranteed democratic rights and rights to and freedoms common to Western democracy. So how could Israel possibly be called a Palestinian state? Sorry, how could Israel possibly be called an apartheid state by the definition of apartheid? And the answer is that they actually twisted the definition of apartheid beyond any of its original recognition, and that it is now sort of become synonymous with a type of cosmic evil, as Professor Bernard Lewis had written back in 2005 in the American Scholar. It has nothing to do really with apartheid. It's sort of an associative term that has come to represent all that is evil in the world today.
So when you say that it's an inherently sort of eliminationist formulation, the Durban sort of decision made by the UN member states, leaving aside the NGOs, it said that Israel is racially oppressing the Palestinians. So it doesn't say Israel can't exist, but the idea is just that it is so morally repugnant to be a racist state that it can't exist. Is that the argument?
The argument is, number one, that Israel as an entity, as a nation state, is inherently racist. You see, the difference between Israel being termed an apartheid state today, that libel, and the original concept of apartheid, is that in original apartheid South Africa, in which I was there in 1975 and 1976, by the way, I was a young, highly ranked tennis player, and I actually was invited by the government to participate in some government sanctioned tennis tournaments there. So I witnessed real apartheid. But what they're saying about Israel today is that Israel, you can't fix Israel. The original apartheid regime in South Africa was boycotted internationally as a regime, and then was then, of course, subject to reform, and then a completely sort of renewed South Africa that was democratic in nature. But what they're saying about Israel is that because Israel is inherently incorrigible, Israel is inherently racist, it means towards its some 1,800,000 or 1,900,000 Palestinian citizens of Israel,
quote unquote,
that is,
yeah,
the quote unquote, that is being conflated with or co-joined with the political crisis ongoing that regarding the Palestinian Arabs, most, the vast majority of which live under the internationally sanctioned control of the Palestinian Authority in areas A and B of the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, and then, of course, 100% under the Iran-backed Hamas regime in Gaza. So there's this extraordinary, you know, salad bowl of chaos that has been going, that has been reflected in this completely bizarre and illogical, and deceitful application of apartheid to Israel. That's why Israel today is considered an incorrigible regime. It can't be corrected. It has to be dismantled the way Professor Mark Lamont Hill has referred to in the, the former CNN commentator who was fired for these remarks.
For anti-Semitism,
in the UN General Assembly. So Israel, as Professor Mark Lamont Hill, who's a full professor of Rutgers University, says, it's from the river to the sea. There is no opportunity for Israel to exist in any form as a nation state in the Middle East, according to the new accepted, mainstreamed, regularized version of apartheid that exists today.
Former Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, I believe, was the only head of state to speak at Durban 2 and 3 in 2009 and 2011, where he openly denied the Holocaust. He did that in 2009, and then he was invited back and did it again in 2011. Can you tell me a little bit more about sort of Iran's involvement in getting this off the ground, the sort of anti-Israel libels at Durban?
Well, sure. First of all, it's very important that you mention former President Ahmadinejad, because he openly denied the Holocaust while planning the next one. And that gives him, makes him, you know, sort of doubly mendacious and doubly guilty. But I think that, you know, Iran, since the revolution in 1979 and the return from France of Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, has been really front and center in the international community of placing Israel as the, you know, what they call the little evil. The United States is the little Satan. The United States is the great Satan, and Britain as the middle Satan. So this whole notion of defamation, dehumanization, demonization of the Jewish collective by Iran, they had really turned that into a standard, but people in the West didn't really pay attention because they said, oh, you know, it's those extremist Shiites that beat themselves with chains, drawing blood from their own backs from the age of 10 in mass parades, that are calling for the destruction of the West, and the ultimate takeover of actually of the world, which is the language that Ahmadinejad used regularly. And so did Khomeini, and Khamenei uses it, but a little bit more of a sophisticated manner. So I think that the major problem with Iran has been less Iran, but more the West and Israel. Israel has not responded, in my view, effectively or urgently enough against the rhetorical, ideological assault against its existence that Iran led between starting in 1979, and of course Osama bin Laden, whose mentor, by the way, was the Palestinian cleric Abdullah Azam from a place close to Jenin. They, in advancing the global jihad, following the rhetorical, ideological, and terror example of the Iranian regime, advanced this type of language against Israel. Remember, it was Osama bin Laden that said that Israel was the third objective in the global jihad to be destroyed, and kept referring to Israel as part of the Zionist Crusader Alliance, that it is due for destruction. So all of this, murderous rhetorical and ideological assault, and I keep using this language with you. We are facing an ideological war against our existence as a small, democratic, Jewish majority nation state in the Middle East. And the roots of this ideological war, they go way back. They go back 100 years, but nonetheless, Iran, it's beginning in 1979, has played a central role in sort of regularizing this murderous rhetoric in the international community. And then the social networks and, the evolution of social networks in the 90s, social networks a little bit later, but the beginning of the internet in the 1990s, and then the advance of social networks has intensified this assault tremendously.
It'll be interesting to see next week how the 20th anniversary Durban conference turns out. Doesn't sound like it could be anything good.
It's not good, but I think there is a silver lining in that Italy has pulled out, France has pulled out, which is very important in terms of setting a bar for Western Europe. Germany has pulled out. Czech Republic has pulled out. Holland has pulled out. United States has pulled out. The English speaking countries have pulled out. Britain, Australia, New Zealand. This is all very important because these countries did not pull out in 2001, except for the United States and Israel.
We now have 16 countries that pulled out, which is more than in 2011 when there were 14. Eastern European countries that joined in.
And we have something as of 2016 called the IHRA, International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, working definition on anti-Semitism. And I think that with enough pressure by people and organizations of goodwill, that definition should be morally enforced. And it should be it's not a legal definition. It's only a moral mandate, but we at least have international, convergence, and we also have acceptance by the EU27, as well as a number of other democracies in Latin America and the English speaking countries that calling Israel an apartheid state is outright anti-Semitism, not to mention the Nazification of Israel. Now that is in an official working definition that has been accepted by the major powers around the world, and it is up to those countries to enforce that moral mandate and not allow international organizations such as the UN to upend and uproot and dismantle their own founding charter, which calls for fighting against racism of any kind. And here, this is another moment of self-immolation of the United Nations.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This has been very interesting.
Pleasure.
Thanks so much.
All the best. All the best for you.
Just to our readers out there, you're writing a big piece for next weekend about the Durban conference. So we'll look forward to that. And just one last word about the UN. Right. So while the Durban conference is taking place, if I'm not mistaken, also at some point next week, Naftali Bennett is expected to go to the UN, right, to deliver a speech at the UN General Assembly. He was recently in the United States for his meeting with President Biden. As we're recording this, he might be back or on his way back from Egypt and Sharm el-Sheikh in the Sinai, where he met with President Sisi. Lots of a flurry of diplomatic activity on his part.
Yeah, which is interesting because when he came into office, people said that, foreign affairs were not his priority, that there are a lot of domestic issues he wanted to address. But you can't avoid it being Prime Minister of Israel. The whole world has things to say about Israel's diplomatic situation. Although the UN, I think, it's a political thing. It doesn't make a difference, diplomatically, I think, if Bennett gave the speech or if Yair Lapid gave the speech and if Bennett went in person or if Bennett went on Zoom, which is an option that many world leaders are still taking this year. But politically, for domestic consumption, it will look really good if he can give a strong speech at the UN. Maybe he will even come up with some Netanyahu-style gimmick. In the past, we had on jfos.com a bingo card or a few bingo cards of like predicting what Netanyahu might say in his speech. I don't think I'm going to have one for Bennett this year because he's too new to be that predictable. But it'll be interesting to see which tropes he will revive.
I will guess that he is not going to pull out any gimmicks or any cardboard cartoons of nuclear bombs or minutes of silence staring down the delegates in the UN General Assembly. I would guess he's just going to
go for some puns.
He might go for some puns. That's true. But I think he's going to go and just give a speech that he'll try to deliver really well and really strongly and show Israelis that he knows how to speak no less than the former prime minister. And that, like you said, has value from a political, domestic political perspective. With that, we wish all of our listeners a Gmar Chatima Tova, an easy and meaningful fast on Yom Kippur. Thanks for being with us this week on the Jerusalem Post podcast. Please share with all your friends. It's available on all the platforms as well as at jpost.com. Share widely and listen with a lot of attention. We will be back with you next week.